From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I know quite well my country. I know quite well my people. I know quite well the public opinion. I know that who rule in Cuba now, who gives orders now in Cuba, is the public opinion.
That was Fidel Castro speaking via videotape from Havana on the TV program in the U.S. called Face the Nation, January 11th, 1959, approximately 10 days after former dictator Fulgencio Batista fled Cuba, escaping rebel forces and a popular uprising. The passing of Fidel Castro is being mourned by millions of Cubans. A ceremony is scheduled for this weekend, and we will be reporting from there. But before that, we spoke with Tony Solo, our reporter from south of the border, about the legacy of Fidel Castro in Latin America and the Caribbean. I guess it was inevitable, but it's certainly a shock still.
Yeah, and it left people speechless here. And Rosario Murillo, when she was Rosario Murillo does a daily message to people in Nicaragua, updating everybody on the latest activities and any relevant stuff that's happening in the country. And so on yesterday, Saturday, she did a special broadcast. She doesn't normally do one on a Saturday, but she was talking to people about how she and Danielle reacted to the news of Fidel's death, and she said that it just left them speechless. And when she told Danielle late on Saturday night that Fidel had died, he couldn't take it in. He thought he didn't understand what she was saying, because it's just so. And I think that gives you an idea of just how incomprehensible it is, or it was in the moment.
Yeah,
news.
I have a friend on Facebook who posted that the CIA's last assassination attempt, which was a clever plan to wait until Fidel died of old age, succeeded.
Right. Yeah. And those CIA guys, they're real Machiavellian, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They say. Yep.
But And it, for Fidel, he was 90, and you made this point in what you were saying the interview you did with RT, and he's been, and it was 60 years ago that he died on the 60th anniversary of the day that he and Che Guevara and the other comrades who set out all that incredible expedition, the day that they left Mexico as a tiny guerrilla group determined, and it was completely quixotic at the time.
Yep.
They set out from Mexico to 60 years ago, landed on in Cuba clandestinely with a tiny set of equipment and arms, and 3 years later,
two years later, because it was January 1st, 1959, so it was really right. Like, yeah, December 31st, 58, yeah, like 2 years, right. A month and a few days, yeah.
Yeah, so in just 2 years, that tiny group of guerrilla fighters defeated one of the United States gangster bastions,
yep,
in Latin America. And it was,
yep,
just an incredible achievement. And then, yep, everything flowed from that. Everything, the following, what is it, 50 years?
Yep.
60 years? And the following, yeah, 60 years have flowed from that. And as you, yep, pointed out on to the interviewer on RT, and Fidel Castro is essentially a liberator of two continents. I know, Africa and Latin America, because it was his inspiration and the inspiration of the Cuban Revolution, the inspiration of Fidel and his comrades, Che Guevara, Camilo Cienfuegos, and so many others. These incredible Cuban revolutionaries.
Yep.
That transformed Latin America. They made it possible for people like Salvador Allende to come to power in Chile, and then the empire had to react to that.
Right.
And the empire spent the last 60 years reacting to the Cuban Revolution.
Yep, in Grenada, in Nicaragua, in Jamaica, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Chile, in all over the place.
Yeah, and as you so rightly pointed out, Fidel's contribution to the liberation of Southern Africa was absolutely key, along with that of Muammar al-Gaddafi and the Libyan Revolution.
Yep. Yeah, I remember, in fact, I played it yesterday, but I every year I run this on the anniversary. Ted Koppel hosted a town hall meeting in Harlem back in, I think, 1992, something like that, 1990, for Nelson Mandela when he made his first trip to the U.S. And some wise guy in the audience, a Democratic operative, Democratic Party operative type, said to Mandela, "Well, you know, you're singing these songs about democracy and equality and all that, but you hang out with people like Muammar Gaddafi, Fidel Castro, and Yasser Arafat. How do you explain that to us?" And he said, basically, because while we're fighting apartheid, they were putting resources to us while we're waiting for you to even make a public statement. That might be why.
Right. Right. Good for Mandela.
Yeah. He did a good job with that.
So, yeah, here in Nicaragua, and yesterday was a big event in the Plaza de la Revolución, and Daniel spoke to thousands of young people in the Plaza de la Revolución about what Fidel Castro meant for the region and Nicaragua. And people say, "Oh, well, look at all these people like Fidel, like Daniel, and others, and they're so old. What relevance do they have now?" And their relevance is tremendously important moral educators for new generations coming along to take up where they and their comrades left off. And it was like, it was really poignant yesterday, Daniel giving essentially a history lesson to these thousands and thousands of young people in Managua's Plaza de la Revolución. And in doing so, he implicitly was explaining why the Cuban Revolution and why the Nicaraguan Revolution and why the revolutionary processes in Latin America continue to be relevant today, not just for Latin America but for the whole world. When you look back, people referred to Fidel Castro as the last of the great personalities of the 20th century, and when people put him in that context, they're putting him in the context of Mao Zedong, of the great revolutionary leaders of the communist revolutions of the last century, Ho Chi Minh and Muammar al-Gaddafi. And all these tremendous personalities that challenged the dominance of Western imperialism around the world. And so when Daniel was speaking yesterday, he was speaking in a context where Western imperialism, although it's kind of still giving the last kicks of a dying person, and is finished. And it seems to me that, and I wrote briefly about this in an article about the APEC summit that was held the previous weekend.
Right.
At that APEC summit, you had President Xi Jinping, President Vladimir Putin, and President Barack Obama, and a group of leaders from the Southeast Asian countries, Korea, South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, and four Latin American countries, the four Latin American countries that are members of the Pacific Alliance. That's Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and Chile. And that, but what that meeting symbolized was, and there was a Barack Obama, President Obama, trying to rescue what, you know, what's left of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and trying to convince an extremely skeptical audience of world leaders that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is still relevant. And whereas President Xi Jinping and President Vladimir Putin were offering the assembled world leaders from Southeast Asia, East Asia, and the Pacific countries of South America and Mexico, they were offering them a vision of integration into the massive development of Eurasia. Yeah. And I think Pepe Escobar has written a lot about this, and other people as well. Yeah. But essentially, the U.S. has nothing to offer those countries. And the, right. the U.S. economy is in completely stagnant, if not in recession. And whereas for all the difficulties that China is having adjusting to the legacy of the 2007-2008 crisis, it still remains an extremely vibrant, dynamic economy. And the same is true of Russia. Russia is remaking its economy in the Eurasian context, and strengthening its economy. The counterproductive sanctions imposed by the United States and its European Union allies have actually meant a resurgence of Russian economic independence, and that is what Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin brought to the APEC summit. Now, the APEC summit is a kind of neoliberal love fest,
right?
And so there's nothing revolutionary in economic and political terms about the content of that summit. But what was revolutionary is that it's unquestionable now that we're in a multipolar world.
That's right.
And Fidel Castro was one of the key people that made that happen.
Yeah, that was one of the points that I wanted to make in those interviews, was that the example that Castro and Cuba, because it was, you know, a largely united effort across the population, gave of, here's only a few million people on a little island 90 miles from the United States that can say no for 58 years and survive and grow.
Right. Yeah, and grow, and by the force of it, the sheer moral force of its example. And I think that Fidel Castro's contribution has essentially been a tremendous moral example inspired people to say, well, if they can do it, well, we can too. And you can see that. And look at Brazil, for example. Ignacio Lula da Silva is a very good friend of Fidel Castro. And a generation younger, right? And a bit like Daniel Ortega. Daniel Ortega and Ignacio Lula da Silva, similar generation. And then another generation down was Hugo Chavez and Nestor and Cristina Kirchner and all those people in Pepe Mujica, right? And so what Fidel's moral example enabled and facilitated was this, what some people refer to, and I think Hugo Chavez used to refer to it, as the second emancipation of Latin America. And Fidel made that happen, and he's made it possible. For example, working together with Hugo Chavez, they made possible this incredible ALBA initiative, that is an alliance of countries with progressive governments in Latin America and the Caribbean, is based on solidarity. It's not based on competition, not based on corporate capitalist competition. It's based on the sovereign autonomy of nations and their ability to work together in a spirit of solidarity. And you can see that, for example, in the way that Misión Milagro, this in Cuban and Venezuelan initiative to assist people who have problems with their vision. I mean, just in Nicaragua, 100,000 people have benefited from that program and regained their sight. You know, and that's and over across the region, the number runs into millions.
Yeah, well, across the world. I mean, if you think about how many Cuban doctors have gone out, A, treated people so they stayed alive and then produced, you know, over their lives, taught doctors, and so now you have doctors in all these places where there were none, and showed people how to build a medical infrastructure. And that reaches, I don't know, more than a billion people, I'm going to guess.
Oh, yeah, sure. And the sheer moral caliber of the Cuban Revolution was demonstrated in the recent outbreak of, when was it, last year or the year before?
Last year, Zika.
Of Ebola.
Ebola in Africa, yep. In West Africa.
In Africa. Yep. And as far as I'm aware, apart from maybe a handful of individuals who took it on themselves as an individual initiative, I'm sure that there were some Western doctors who went and participated. Yes. On their own initiative, but as a government initiative, only the Cuban government sent a significant contingent, hundreds of medical personnel to they disembarked in Freetown in Sierra Leone, to West Africa to assist the West African countries affected by that outbreak, to deal with and manage and cope with the outbreak of this extremely virulent, frightening disease, lethal disease, the Ebola virus. Yep. And Cuba did that, and it was kind of latter day version of the expeditionary force that Cuba sent in the 1970s to defend Angola against the South African apartheid regime's aggression, backed by, it has to be said, by the United States and its other Western allies. You know, and it was Cuba that defended Angola.
That's right.
And it was Cuba that made it possible finally to defeat, as you pointed out, the apartheid regime.
Yep. Yeah, and folks on the ground in those places know that and remember it. That's the thing. They were asking me, one of them, I don't remember which interview, about Castro's legacy. And I was like, first of all, Castro's legacy is the legacy of the Cuban people, because his primary role was to organize people and to do these things, and the people did it. And as they did it, they left it done in various places around the world. And those people, that's where Castro's legacy lies.
Right. And then when you look at what's happening in the region currently, you have these, you have people talking about a conservative right wing restoration in the region, and I can't help thinking that Fidel's passing also marks the kind of writing on the wall for the right wing in Latin America, and it sounds a paradoxical thing to say.
I agree,
but Fidel's example, that they have been unable to defeat it. You know, and that is going to persist and prevail in Latin America. That example of fundamental solidarity and belief in human potential and focus on the needs of the human person. And Fidel, that's what Fidel Castro stands for in Latin America, despite all the nonsense that you'll read in the Social Democrat and liberal press about the dictator Castro, all that nonsense.
Right.
And no dictator lasts as long as Castro did, without the support of his people.
Right. And without the support of an external power like the United States, and rather in the face of overt hostility and repeated attempts at assassination, coups, invasion, etc.
Yeah, and you can see that in the attempts by Mauricio Macri to install his reactionary right-wing regime and the completely failed neoliberal economic agenda. And it's just, it's beyond stupid.
Yep.
And you can see the same thing happening in Brazil. And obviously, we don't know how events are going to pan out. But, and as I said earlier, the writing is on the wall for those right-wing regimes. And they've essentially had it. And it's difficult to see. And the only response the United States is able to offer in terms of policy is chaos.
Right.
And look at Mexico, look at Honduras, look at Guatemala. These are regimes closely allied to the United States. And it'll be interesting to see how the new regime under Donald Trump manages to shuffle and juggle its relationships with Latin America. But it's difficult to see. It's impossible to see any progress being made for Mexico and Guatemala and Honduras, for example, until they adopt the kind of policies for which ultimately Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution are the inspiration.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, look, you're being offered a model of being looted. And if you say yes to that model, you get looted. Now, after you get looted long enough, the people get a little restless. And if you try to loot them more, they get real restless, and then you're gone. And even if you manage to grab power for a minute, again, like they've done in Argentina and Brazil, all they can offer is more looting, and people get that pretty quickly.
Here in Nicaragua, Nicaragua is going through a period of one of the most successful periods, in fact, without question, the most successful period in its history. You know, a stability, peace, prosperity, and Nicaragua stands out in the region as a kind of beacon of light and hope compared to what's happening in Honduras and Guatemala.
And that's now before the canal's constructed. Once that happens, assuming that that happens, I mean, the economy doubles right away. Everything you just said, like, moves up in a grand scale.
Yeah, people have been quite skeptical about, you know, whether or not the canal's going to happen or not. But I think the feeling is that it's definitely going to happen, and that was confirmed by Wang Jing, the Chinese entrepreneur, the Hong Kong-based entrepreneur, who's at least the public face of the project. I mean, it's pretty clear that the Chinese government supports the project; otherwise, it wouldn't even be on the table.
Right.
But and he wrote to in a Christmas message. Sorry, not a Christmas message. A congratulatory message to Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo on their electoral success early in November, and he wrote and confirmed that the canal is definitely going ahead. There was even a report in the Guardian during the week in which they accept. I think their reporter, a guy called Jonathan Watts, and Watts is reporting in that piece that appeared in The Guardian that the canal does seem to be going ahead, and people accept that it's going to be going ahead. So, you know, and apart from that, but even just say something happened and the canal didn't go ahead for one reason or another, there's so much else happening in the Nicaraguan economy. And and with the canal, the Nicaraguan economy is set to grow by about anything between 9% and 11% a year, something like that. Mm-hmm. But without the canal, it's still going to grow at around 5% or 6% a year.
Which is pretty good.
Which makes the economic, it just shows how stupid and unnecessary and irrelevant the economic policy making is in the United States and Western Europe, and it's absurd that the United States is in a situation where its economy is stagnating or in recession. And look at all the resources that the United States have. It's completely stupid for the U.S. people to be in a position where they're facing economic hardship. I mean, it's just so stupid, yep, given all the advantages of the United States, and the same's true in Europe. And that's why people like Trump and Marine Le Pen and Nigel Farage and all these kind of right-wing libertarian-style figures, that's why they're doing so well politically.
Right. Yeah, because they're at least speaking to it, and you know, even if it's rhetorically. But, you know, that's the same thing, by the way, with Sanders. I mean, they were calling him a socialist. He's barely a Democrat, but... let alone a social democrat, even in the European sense of the word. But the need is basically the condition of people is so desperate that they're looking for anything, and it's not being offered by the left.
Yeah, and people ask, you know, what led to the development of progressive regimes in Latin America following the electoral victory of Hugo Chavez back in whenever it was, 1998, and the answer is very clear, that they were offering a policy agenda inspired by Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution, that meets the needs of the human person, that meets ordinary people's needs, their health needs, their education needs, what's happening. One of the interesting things that's happening in Nicaragua is that they're now trying to set up a kind of open university, an online university. You know, there are various questions about, you know, how successful it's likely to be and how coherent it is in terms of the overall needs of the Nicaraguan society and economy. But I mean, that's just another example of how, the government intervention and government public sector driven initiatives can completely transform a society in terms of its ability to meet the population's basic needs. Where does that come from? It comes from Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution.
Yeah, well, if your power rests on a policy that promises that, it sort of compels you to deliver it. And
right.
And if the institutions are sufficiently democratic, there's accountability, and so there's pressure on the government, which can marshal resources for the benefit of the public better than any other mechanism, for them to do that and do it on behalf of the people to at least satisfy what they want, or else they're gone.
Right. You know, and obviously in ideological terms, and that's a complete vindication of the theoretical arguments from 19th century philosophers like Karl Marx, Engels, and
right.
You know, it's a vindication of the driving principles of the Russian Revolution, mm-hmm. and the Chinese Revolution. You know, and whatever one thinks about the subsequent developments in those countries' societies, and the ultimate drive is to meet people's fundamental needs in an equal way and in a truly democratic way.
Yep.
And that's, you know, and that's what Fidel Castro, that's the great lesson of Fidel Castro.
Yep, which, you know, you mentioned earlier, but was picked up by Hugo Chavez and then applied, including the principle of solidarity, which had Venezuela assisting all in places like Nicaragua, for example, with material things like they didn't have doctors, but they did have electrical generators that they gave you to build the electrical infrastructure and things like that. And Cuba sent doctors.
Yeah, and Daniel Ortega recently, another interesting bit of news that takes us back to the whole argument about is there a multipolar world or not. And Nicaragua hosted the signing ceremony for the Central American Free Trade Agreement with South Korea.
Oh.
And there was a very high-level delegation from South Korea and that included high-level parliamentarians and the country's minister for industry, trade and technology. Industry, trade and energy, I think. and they were present for that signing. And at the same time, and so they took the opportunity to have a ceremony initiating a study center in Central America, which is going to train thousands of young technicians and specialists from all over Central America in how to develop the uses of broadband internet technology for the region's development. Where is that based? It's based in Nicaragua.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.